Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's a field, it's a cultural field, the one of architecture and design, that is not fixed in time. So it's not a subject matter that you always teach. It's not, I'm not always teaching the past. We're actually working on the present, and the present is always moving.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jamie.
I'm Amy, and this is Clever. And today we're talking to architect Elena Manfredini. Originally from Italy, she's now based in Los Angeles. Her architecture firm, Atelier Manfredini, is responsible for colorful facades, graphic patterns, and bold statements.
She's also currently the chair of Southern California Institute of Architecture's graduate program. She has a passion for education, the philosophy of creativity, and the ideas of genius and truth. It's just me this time. Amy couldn't be there, but we had an awesome conversation. Let's get to it.
My name is Elena Manfredini. My design office is in Venice, California, and I have an architectural practice that works between art and architecture, and also I am an educator. I teach because I think teaching allows me to share something I am passionate about with young, talented, like-minded people, and that's probably the best job one could ask for. And I am an architect because I think this profession allows me to think about ideas that are not already existing. So there is this speculative component of architecture that I think it's what drives my desire to be involved in this field.
So I want to bring it back to the beginning. I would love to know more about your childhood. Did you grow up in Italy? Can you talk about your childhood and your family and what it was like to be a small Elena?
I don't know if there was a small Elena. There's always Elena. I have a theory that we don't grow up into adults. We just cope with reality with more and more intellectual and skillful means. But we tend to be our own people, very young and very old in the same possible way. I am Italian, as you can hear from my accent. So I was born and raised in Italy, specifically in Bologna, which is a city between Milan and Florence. And I lived there for 22 years. My mother and my father owned a family business that has been in the family for a couple of generations. They designed and built mechanical equipment and large machinery to extract building materials from quarries, which I think is an incredibly different experience of childhood just on its own because of what my parents did and where, therefore, I grew up, because they had a factory in Bologna and we lived very close to the factory, and the factory was also a place where everybody in my family worked. So my parents were always close by. My family was always close by, and my cousins. So I remember that the experience of working and the experience of family were in my childhood. I also have great memories of my parents working together, which I think it's very rare, and having access to their presence and to their intellectual capital anytime I wanted to go down the stairs and see what they were doing. I also think that work and my work ethic came from them in many ways, from their childhood, because work for them was really paramount, was all they did, and family was within work. And I think with that came a strong work ethic an idea of a career that supports not only your family, but also employees. And I think there was really nothing light or careless about my family. In many ways, they worked all the time, and we were part of that big picture. I take the idea of drawing from my father. He had a technical background, and he loved to draw, mechanical drawings. And I've seen him drawing since I was a child. And the idea of just drawing line with ink on Mylar, I think, is for me connected to seeing him designing, inventing, and building things. I think that that relationship was, whether or not I like to say that, but quite forming in my decision afterwards to become an architect.
So you started drawing at a young age. Were there any other things you were doing? Were you working with your hands, or did you spend a lot of time outside in nature?
I realized very early on as a child that I was academically strong more than socially inclined, and that being academically strong gave me a certain comfort zone and ability to distance myself from social activities. So I think it was very clear to me that school was a playground for both intellectual abilities and social skills. And I definitely tended to study as my first focus. I think drawing was maybe my only hidden pleasure. Let's say that's something that I was not asked to do in school, and also was always denied, but I drew almost relentlessly in school and even before school on any surface that I was given to draw on or allowed to draw on. Many times I actually was reprimanded for drawing on my desk where I couldn't do that.
Oh. So when you started getting a little bit older, became a teenager, got into high school, were you also still very focused on academics and studying, or did you have any rebellious times, any teen angst?
Italy is a society where social classes still exist. When I say this, people don't really understand what I mean, but it means that if you're a lawyer, your son or daughter would be a lawyer, and that you will have a career that the economic and social status of your parents allowed, both in terms of access to education, but even when education is free, which is true for Italy, it's more of a possibility of work. So the biggest rebellion, I think, is knowing that you have a way out of that only through your means, and that it cannot be just that. And realizing that my intellectual strength was a valid way out of the life was measured on my parents' financial status was mainly what I was focused on in high school. I have to say, I needed to leverage and cultivate those aspects to find a place where I could have the kind of career that I wanted to. This is something that comes across quite quickly, I think, when you go to high school in Italy, especially for the high school I went to. I went to a liberal art school where we studied Latin, ancient Greek, philosophy, art history, Italian, and math. And maybe we studied English for only 2 years. So it's the kind of education that usually prepares you for a political life. A life, you know, of politics or...
Did you think that was something you were interested in doing, or...?
I think it was the best high school in the city, and that was the thought, you know, at 14, it's not... that was a career path. It was more my parents trying to figure out what school they should send me to, and they sent me to a good school, more or less, which was a public school, but somehow it's a public school where everybody that wants to get into politics or law goes to. It became quite evident soon that in order to craft your own path in that society and being free to choose, educate yourself, and somehow succeed or fail in the professional field, one needed to work hard to get out of it. And this is kind of the reason which in many ways brought me to the understanding that I needed to go somewhere else that was not Italy to have that kind of more creative career.
Oh, interesting. So was that at the point of graduating high school?
No, that was actually later. I went to engineering school first.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And then I went to the United States afterwards.
So going to engineering school in Italy, what prompted you to study engineering?
It was a completion of my education. As I told you, I went to a high school that was a liberal art in the, not in the American sense, it's truly in the European sense. And I think for however amazing that experience was and how much cultural experience that was, it also did not allow me to get in touch with technology or math or geometry or other subject matters that were not part of the curriculum. And I thought at that point that I needed to have also the scientific aspect of life. Somehow that kind of big chunk of knowledge for me to complete my education. So it was more of a desire to make a round decision about what I knew rather than saying I am going to be an engineer. I mean, clearly my father had a company that had a lot of engineering in it, and my sister also is an engineer, my husband is an engineer, so there is quite a bit of engineers in my family. I think it's something that always attracts me, the way in which as a society we create a theory of how things work, which is science. And I think that was actually the academic component of this, the pyramid of knowledge, learning what for centuries humankind has been piling up in terms of knowledge to arrive to where we are today was truly attractive to me, probably much more than the profession of being an engineer. To be honest with you, I was not even clear about what that would have been. You choose certain things that at a young age, not knowing if that is really what fits your nature. Academically, it did. Professionally, probably not.
That's interesting. So then you decided to pursue something a little more creative. Is that when you went to the U.S.?
Yes. U.S. was because it was an exchange program between Italy and the University of California. And at that point, I was in my first year of engineering, and my partner and I thought about the idea of going abroad and to do 1 year of education in the United States. Actually, it was his choice to go to the United States, much more than mine. And we both applied and we were accepted from UCLA with a scholarship to study there 1 year. So it was probably never meant to be the moment of change that in reality this became. It was at the beginning supposed to be just 9 months in Los Angeles to learn English, to do, to go to school, to be exposed to a different educational system. And it became a change in career, in change in geographical location, and also a place where I've been living for 22 years. So
yeah,
I never knew when I left that it would have been such a divider in my life. Really, I'm now 44, so I think I spent 22 years in Italy and 22 in Los Angeles.
Wow.
That was a moment where my life bifurcated, and probably I could have not predicted that. I was just looking at 9 months.
So what changed when you got to Los Angeles and you spent some time there? What happened in your life that you decided to make that decision?
I think the decision came slowly, meaning I never thought I would stay forever until I realized that I was there for a long time. But it hit me very fast, the idea that American education was offering something completely different from what I had before. The ratio, I mean, something as stupid as the ratio, faculty, students was something I never experienced. You have to understand that when you go to school in Italy, maybe you have a class of 200 people, 300 people in front of a teacher. And so these are lecture halls where you listen to somebody speaking, but there is almost never an opportunity for a direct exchange or to really work next to somebody that you consider to be a master in your field. Whereas in Los Angeles, I was taking some classes in architecture because I needed some classes there to complete my education in Italy. And suddenly I was working with phenomenal instructors that I realized I saw their work on magazines when I was in Italy, and suddenly these people were teaching me a portfolio class, a studio, a software. I never had that before. I never realized that these people taught and they had quite strong footprint into education and that American schools allowed for that contact. So I think that was the first thing. the incredible creative opportunity and exposure to these personalities. I also think I liked the meritocracy of the United States, meaning that for somebody like me coming from somewhere else, they had not aged, you know, I had no footprint in the United States. I knew nobody. Mm-hmm. I came with a luggage. And still it felt like what would happen to me was simply dependent on my ability to, you know, to work, my intellectual capacity, and my willingness to put effort in what I wanted to do. And this is something that people here take for granted. When you come from countries where it doesn't matter how much you work at something, you cannot expect to get it. I think that kind of shift was a substantial one. And even it was in young age at 22, I realized that even in the academic system that meritocracy happened, and it was quite powerful for me. I mean, you could actually teach. You could take up the teaching assistant position. You could work in stores so that you can, you know, sustain yourself. There was actually a whole economy that if you were willing to work hard at it, would help you pay tuition, would help you with scholarship, would help you sustain yourself at a fairly young age. And that was, I thought, empowering for somebody like me who wants to be an author. Now, in my life, I thought this is actually a great opportunity. And I think those things were not easy to come by in Italy, actually. Italy, I mean, there's this idea of postcards of what it is, and it's a phenomenal, you know, it's an incredible place. I'm blessed by the fact that I grew up in a place where culture, music, arts is everywhere in everybody's domain and is always under your eyes. It's something that I think as a childhood, having that is a phenomenal upbringing, because that gives you certain things that visually you don't get anywhere else, certain culture you don't get anywhere else. But also, on the other end, it's a society where a lot has been done already, that the economic power is not as strong as it is in the United States. There is less of a place for a creative person to make new things, I think. It's more of a place of history, of remembrance, of scholarship, of culture, also of food and all the things that we're famous for. But when it comes to creating newness or technology or making things, I think the United States was a much more prolific place to be, and especially Los Angeles was, at that point, at the end of the 90s, also was a place of revolution, I would say, in terms of digital revolution in the field of architecture and art. That was the first time where truly computers invaded schools of architecture, schools of art. It was an exciting moment to go from an analog education to a completely digital one. And I was just luckily in between those. I was at the cusp of that change. And that change was interesting to me. So being exposed to a completely digital education was also interesting to me, because I was coming from the most traditional one, where you would draw monuments and draw them by hand and do these phenomenal, beautiful pieces. But on the other hand, I also wanted to see the possibilities of working with different media. And American University, let's say, at that point, where I think propelling that change that I think now is a new normal, and everybody has those tools, everybody understands that was as being much beyond academic realms. But at that point in history, I think academia was still a place of research in that way. And that was an interesting recipe, I thought. The openness of the United States, the technology advancements that just by luck were going on at that point, and the architectural program at UCLA that was very progressive back then.
So just walk me through the path quickly. So you ended up getting a degree at UCLA. Did you start teaching right away, or did you start the Atelier Manfredini right away, or did you work as an architect for another firm?
I got, first of all, my degree in engineering. So I went home during the summer and I got my degree in engineering. So I'm a structural engineer also, my master. And then I got my master's degree at UCLA. After a while, after that, I worked for 3 years for another architect. And after that, I started teaching and I opened my office at the same time. And I was teaching, I think, my first class when I was 29.
Oh, interesting. So what drew you to education? Was it just because you had always been interested in academics as a young child?
I think it's a mix of decision making. Some of them are pragmatic, and some of them are more an ideal setting of research. I think what you have to understand is that education, especially architectural education, is great platform for research as well. So not only you are teaching someone else, but you are truly learning with a group of talented people certain things all together. So, and they might be your colleagues, but also they are your students sometimes. And my students also were almost my age when I started. And so there is this idea that through academia, you can build a body of knowledge. And I think that has been always attractive to me as a way to speculate what architecture can do at its highest potential. I also think universities offer a technical platform of tools that you rarely have at the beginning of your career in an office. Just having access to certain tools was important to me. And I'm not talking about computers, but rapid prototyping, machinery, robotics, all those things that are actually part of the new set of tools and palettes for an architect. At that point, actually, they were quite expensive and rare, and universities had the funds to purchase them. And as an instructor, as well as a student, you have a chance to work with them. And so that also was, I think, part of the attraction. Also, you know, it's part of your personal growth, I think, to understand the transition between being a student and to be an instructor. So I don't think it's a very difficult step to think that mm-hmm. what you've learned, you want to then implement it and pass it on to other people. There is a sense of legacy and enjoyment in that sharing of knowledge.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, clever listeners, we're getting excited for New York Design Week in May. This year will be better than ever. ICFF, North America's leading platform for contemporary design, will take place from May 19th to the 21st at the Javits Center in New York City. I'll be there, and I'm excited to let you know how Clever is collaborating with ICFF for Launchpad at Wanted, formerly known as Wanted Design Manhattan, and the Emerging Designer Showcase. Launchpad is an international platform for emerging designers that introduces new concepts and showcases prototypes of furniture, home accessories, and lighting. It is the best place for manufacturers to meet new designers, discover fresh ideas, and potential products to develop. The best of Launchpad winners will be selected by a jury of renowned industry professionals, led by yours truly. And they will go on to be featured in another edition of the popular Emerging Designers Showcase. I'll be leading the Emerging Designers Showcase live on the Talks main stage, where the 5 Launchpad finalists will have a chance to present their projects to our esteemed panel of professionals. It's always a really good time. So mark your calendars for Sunday, May 19th at 4 p.m. Both Launchpad and the Emerging Designer Showcase are presented with media partners Clever, that's us, and Design Milk, and with support from American Standard and Lumens. Visit ICFF.com to learn more and register to attend. Those are the letters ICFF.com. Come by and say hi. I would love to see you there. Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises.
So do you feel like you get something back from your students that you bring to your own architecture practice as you're teaching them? Are you also kind of learning anything from them?
I think anybody that teaches would tell you that the act of teaching is intrinsically an act of learning at the same time. And I do think also that it's true for the students. They're not only learning from the teacher, they're actually learning from each other, from your peer, in terms of ideas, creativities, tools. There is, you know, an incredible freshness in working with young, like-minded, talented people, and they push you and you push them. And it's a field, it's a cultural field, the one of architecture and design, that is not fixed in time. So it's not a subject matter that you always teach. It's not, I'm not always teaching the past. We're actually working on the present, and the present is always moving. And that is the reason that I think it's a fundamental difference between certain subject matter where you teach scholarly approaches to the past, and that might be fixed in time, your approach to it. But for an architect and a designer, when you design and work with students, you learn from them while you teach them what you know.
I want to go back to something you said in the very beginning of the podcast where you talked about the child and the adult being the same. Can you talk a little bit more about that? That sounded really interesting to me.
I had a child 2 years ago, and maybe what I'm saying also comes from that. And I realized when I saw him for the first time that his soul is completely formed. I mean, he, yes, is going through all the experiences and learning process that a child would go through, but there is something, there is an essence of what a human being is that I'm not sure I can really put a finger onto, that it belongs to us since the beginning of time. And I think when I was a child, I remember clearly who I was, and I still think the essence of that person is in me. You just craft and your responses according to your experience. But I don't think one becomes really an adult. I think we are really adult somehow when you're born, and you just learn how to react to reality and how to interact with it. I don't think the older you get, the better you get, or younger you are, the more inexperienced you are. I think it's actually a sort of coping mechanisms and that get you through life, but there is an essence that I think is the same at every age you have.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Probably because I'm in my 40s, there's a lot of like these existential questions that have been coming up. And I feel like when you said that, I was thinking, oh yeah, I can kind of relate to that right now in my life. So thank you for expanding on that topic. I want to ask you too, another thing that was really interesting to me is when we talked to you in episode 85, which is the Be Original USA sponsored episode, where we had a panel of experts in LA. During that conversation, you talked about the idea of genius and the role of creativity in society. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective. Could you kind of reiterate that here and just expand on that idea a little bit more?
Yeah, I think nowadays the concept of genius is pluralized, or we can say democratized, so much that the genius is ordinary. Everybody's a genius. Crowds are a genius. Everybody's a genius. You have a little bit of a genius in yourself. But that is now. And in reality, there is still some misconception, I think, of what genius is and why it came to be. I even teach a class that starts explaining how we got to this point in history. I think when somebody thinks about the word genius, it's generally understood as this paradigm of originality, intuition, talent, and brilliance. Now everybody wants to be a genius because there's something about it that really emerges as a cultural hero. But the cultural hero is something that was pushed forward in the 18th century. And the idea that also the genius creates something that is personal and new. I went to this liberal arts school, so which means that sometimes I rely a bit on the on Latin and Greek knowledge. If you think about Homero was blind, meaning that one of the most important, two of the most important books of literature from Western civilization supposedly have been written by somebody who cannot see. I think the fact that he was blind was important because it meant that he was bred into bad news, breath of a god. And basically the idea of inspiration comes from Latin. It means inspire. Truly, it's not you that have these special qualities. It's God that gives you this ability to produce something extraordinary. I mean, in Greek culture, it was called the demon, which is a lesser god. In Latin, it was a genius. Then afterwards, when it became more of a religious concept, became a guardian angel, or a patron saint. So the idea was that truly it's not about the human man, the person that does what it does, but it's about the fact that they're vessels for divinity to go through them. I always tell my students, and maybe this is important also for you guys, I'm asking them always, what are royalties in your opinion? No, when a designer is paid royalties, which I think many of the people that are listening to us today want to get paid by companies in royalties. The truth is that the king is the owner of any copyright and any ideas, because the king is a representative of God, the ultimate creator. Therefore, the king is the middleman that gets the cut. So This even just tells you that any design creation in the history of design is not based on the ability of the person writing or singing or playing or sculpting or brushing, but is about the fact that that was a vessel of somebody divine. And the king would get the cut, no, of the purchase of the artistic output, because he's representative of God on earth. Mm-hmm. So it really, truly, on the 18th century, the genius and originality came to coexist, no? And so doing and making and thinking something that nobody else has done before became what a genius is, or create became the idea of creating something new. So that's really a radical departure. And truly, this radical departure is what we still are into, if you think about it, because the concept of genius today is truly a byproduct of the 18th century. So the withdrawal from God, a sense of anxiety of being human, the idea of enhanced sense of agency, so humans are actually authors. And so the monarch genius really stands for our old idea of divine genius. So that's when, you know, that's when the big shift happened. And I think when people talk about genius, they still consider that. To the point that, I don't know if you know, this is a small fact, but Isaac Newton, for instance, was buried in the Westminster Abbey, which for me was always, when I saw it, was a question mark. Was why would a scientist be in a place of religion? Because truly, the modern genius stands for the idea of the old divine genius. And so at some point, they were even buried into churches. Or even if you think about Einstein, it was maybe the last of this idea of genius. And his brain was sold and sliced afterwards, not the reliquia of the saints and the reliquia of the scientist that is a genius, somehow became something to honor. And I think we still are in this paradigm that, but though it has been broken down, I think only in the past 50 or 60 years, I think that World War II has mined this problem of the genius, bowing before idols, now as seen as elitist or racist or sexist. And genius became really a taboo problem. And now we think that many heads are better than one. We even think that there is genius in all of us. Genius is democratized. And even clouds have an intelligence. And almost nothing is original. We also think that as postmodernism in general, that everything has been said before, nothing is original. And every genius, as we thought in the 18th century, is dead, although some of it remains still in the idea of originality, of the originality and creativity. Brian Eno, I think, says it at best when he says, I don't believe in genius, but I believe in seniors, the scene of the genius, which basically means that we can see a collective manifestation of a general cultural product. And so it's not a single person that produces a creative act that is unique or new, or an incredible contribution, is actually the contemporary society that creates that scene that allows for that to happen.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think that now that we have the internet, which really connects us globally, and we're just inundated with information and new ideas and visuals, do you think that that has contributed at all to this collective genius?
I think it's manifesting the fact that authorship and expertise is not a fixed concept, meaning that, for instance, when you open Wikipedia, we all look for things in Wikipedia. I mean, once upon a time, we opened the Treccani or the library or a book or an encyclopedia. And the encyclopedia was a place where the experts were called to define what things were. And those were printed at a certain time, and those were the author, and those were the experts. And so truth seemed to be fixed in time. And that was a point where I think knowledge was limited. Truth, therefore, was very much a concept that was crystallized. I think nowadays, everybody understands looking at Wikipedia, if you click on the second page, not the second tab, not only you see that, you see all the people that have been contributing to that concept, and they're still contributing. And so you cannot think of truth as being something fixed in time, but it's something that is fluid. Many people participate in, and it's going to change from today to this afternoon to tomorrow. The entries of each of Wikipedia definitions are updated anytime, and everybody can update them. So it means that collectively we participate in that construction. I think that is a fundamental difference. I also think the idea of Instagram is a fundamental difference in the fruition of art. If once upon a time museums were the places where one expert would catalog in an archive what was worth it to be called art, I think nowadays people have their first encounter with art through digital media, either it's a website or Instagram or whatever else, but nobody enters in contact with art just going to the museum. You go to the museum because you've seen something before that told you, I should be interested in seeing this in person. And so the content of internet also makes something very important, that the things that are uploaded are not just the things that are in a museum, the things that actually you take. And it's a two-way stream of information, and which means that museums, libraries, all these cultural institutions that were supposed to edit culture are now challenged to find a dialogue with social media, because social medias are a two-way street for not only the expert to say what art is, what a book is worth it, or what the definition of truth is, but everybody participates in that, which I think you can see in two ways. One is a positive way. We have never been so connected. We have never had so many people looking at art as it is today. We have never been so in charge of what our stories. On the other end, how can this institution then find their voice of leading their mission? And their mission was culture, art, knowledge for all. Is the internet a great medium for that? And the answer is yes, probably. Does that become a trend? And what are the other activities that all these institutions should do now in order to create a hierarchy of content for everybody to somehow enjoy? So it's, I think there is a lot to be rethinking about.
Yeah.
I think the genius is only one of the aspects of social media that I think has been for sure put into a new lens. I think the concept of genius has been questioned for longer than that. I would say that even 60 years is the amount of time. I think the concept of genius has changed. But today, I think nobody can even sit back and think that there is any truth in most of the media work you have around you. So it's even a question of defining what truth is, not only what creativity is, what originality is. It's going to an ethical level, is that true? Not only is it new, is it original, is it actually true? Oh. Which is a much bigger question, I think.
Yeah, it is. I want to ask you, I'm really interested in your own work. You have your own firm, Atelier Manfredini, and your work is really very beautiful. It plays with florals and color and pattern and light. And I just want to know what's inside of your brain and how you generate your own ideas. You know, you talk a lot about creativity and originality and ideas, but how do your own ideas manifest?
I think it's always a difficult question, this one to answer. I have a theory that there are two different types of artists in the modern era, the conceptualist and the experimentalist. And conceptualists, I think, are the people that make radical innovation very early in age. The experimentalists, I think, have innovation to develop slowly over a long period of time. Probably mm-hmm. I am more of the second one, the experimentalist. And I don't think these two types, by the way, are distinguished by their importance. I think, historically speaking, you could be a conceptualist and you could be an experimentalist and by the end of your career have a great body of work. So it has nothing to do with what place you have in the history of creativity. It truly is how you go about what you create. I think usually the experimentalists like me are based on aesthetically motivated experimentation. And conceptualists, on the other hand, are more based on a conceptual idea and an execution. I mean, even if you think Cézanne, for instance, I love what he says usually. Cézanne says, I seek in painting. Clearly, he is an experimentalist. So through painting after painting, he modified and researched for, within a long body of work, a certain aesthetic pursuit. Whereas when you read Pablo Picasso, he says, I don't seek, I find. Even just to tell you this incredibly different approach to the idea that Pablo Picasso would have an idea and then would execute it. He finds what he has in mind. Whereas people like Paul Cézanne would create radical work, but the radical work goes through many levels of iteration. I think I'm more that kind of experimentalist innovator. There is a trial error. You arrive to major contribution gradually, whereas conceptual innovators usually go through sudden breakthrough and they formulate new ideas, usually very early in age and also very distinct from each other. I know you asked me about my work, so I would say that a lot of the work I do also has deep roots into work that is germane to painting. So a lot of the work that people describe as floral usually is actually a critique or a way, let's say, a better way to update the problem of representation of nature, which, you know, it's a landscape. And in particular, between the relationship between tableau and tableau vivant and audience and the relationship between the audience and the work. So I work also quite a bit with colors because I think in architecture, color is quite a bit of potential, probably. Color had a special space in painting and in fine arts in general. Did not hold as much of a position in contemporary architecture, at least for quite a bit from modernism on. And I find that digital color is today very important because I think it's a democratizing force for architecture. And I think this has a lot to do with our digital media and our habits that fills our eyes and also our free time of feeds, posts, and tweets. I think, you know, once upon a time, color was truly linked to how you could make color, which meant pigments, physical properties, or shells, insect berries, or chemical materials. Nowadays, color truly belongs to the screen and beams into our eyes many hours a day. And the range of color that are possible today are almost infinite. And so this, I think, is part of this democratizing force, visual democratizing force of internet that has tinted most creative fields, and architecture is one of them. I think colors is also synonymous of subjectivity, openness to interpretation, and truly, I think, opens up the idea of politics of colors and cultural association to many more audiences and singular view than once upon a time. So I think a lot of the work I do is that it's colorful because the function of color is not to present really this vision of an idealized other world, which I think architecture has been doing for a long time. You know, that's the idea of white in architecture. Le Corbusier had also a lot of rippling. Like he would have, if he could have, he would have made people paint white every single home in his city in Switzerland. But really, I think the function of color is not to represent this unitary vision, but truly to prompt people to imagine another world for themselves. It's in its full range of possibilities. So I think that's also part of the work I do, is to bring this pictorial openness and qualities to building facades where actually color did not belong for a long time.
So when you're bringing all of these colors and patterns and florals or nature into your architecture, are you in a way trying to bring people together? Is that kind of what I'm getting from this, and create some sort of universal experience or convey a certain mood or feeling or evoke something in particular?
I think that I'm more places where architecture lives that are the place of images and the place of physical artifact. And in the physical artifact, whether or not we like it, we live with architecture so much of our time. It's the background of our lives. And I think opening up facades to this to become creative canvases, I think, enriches the imagination of the many. I don't think I'm trying to create a single experience. I think most of the work I do has shades of colors, has optical effects embedded in them, has different ways in which you can look at them. And so this is actually, there is a slow and multifaceted quality of the work that creates a single experience in a public space. And that, I think, is what happens when you build. I think also there is another life of architects, which is also the images and the renderings and the pictorial quality. They might exist in digital or physical format of drawings. And I think those as well are part of the arsenal of tools of an architect to start creating an audience that would enjoy or like or substantiate building something like that. So I think any building to be built needs multiple steps. One is the one of when you create something imaginative, you want to also, you have as a duty the one to create an audience for that work so that the work becomes real. So there are multiple steps. I think imagination is the first one. Having an audience that believes in that imagination is very important, whose imagination is trained by your work, and then that creates a desire for the work, and then the work gets built. And so I think the audience, it's a longer process. It's not just I'm creating a spectacle through a facade. It's also I'm creating the desire for that architecture to exist through teachings, through drawings, through renderings, through installations, through things that start building a desire for something different and that seeks into reality.
How do you define whether or not architecture is successful?
I am not sure, as a general term, one could define architecture successful in relationship to the client needs, to the audience response, to the longevity of the piece, to the level of engagement.
There's so many factors.
I think it's difficult to say what is, I mean, I think successful for me, I can tell you what is successful in my practice and what I think makes me want to work on something. And I'm not sure that's successful in general for my client, but definitely that makes me want to do certain things. I think architecture is successful when is able to train collective imagination. I think we're used to seeing boring architecture. I mean, and by boring, I mean completely uninteresting. It goes into the background of our lives, and it is kind of sneaking in as being the only possibility, meaning that we walk in these cities and we don't imagine them to be able to be anything else, because we think what is out there must be what is available to us. In reality, I think architecture that is groundbreaking is the one that shows that other things are possible. And that I think is very successful, because it's not just the building or just the facade or just the artwork that creates that. It's more that you're training people to think that there is an alternative out there. And that, I think, is very important in life in general, to know that what you have is what you choose, but you can also choose and make something else happen. We're really, we are participants in this reality, and being able to be agent in that change is a fundamental knowledge for people living in a democracy. Or it goes beyond just the idea something else could physically be there. Mm-hmm. It's just something else could also happen through your activity and through your participation. So I think that way of framing the audience is very important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to ask you a few personal questions, because you're very passionate in general. You've talked about your passion for architecture and for creativity and for education. Do you have passions outside of your work?
I have so many works that I think I have some time. No, I teach. And I'm the chair of a graduate school, and I have a small practice that deals with art and architecture. So this keeps me quite busy. But I have to say, I truly think that I made of my passion my work, which I think it's an important decision that I made early on, and I think I never choose to do in my life. Also, maybe something besides my my work. I became a mother recently, as I mentioned, and probably motherhood has made me break certain work habits, let's say. I think motherhood is a very common experience, no? Most women become mothers in their lifetime, and most people have a relationship with their mother. So I don't think I'm saying anything that anybody else has an experience. I might not be also very experienced as a mother either, because I've been a mother only for 2 years. But maybe one thing that is fun about being a mother is that it made me completely see in a different way the art is 300 years of art history, which I never truly completely understood before giving birth. You know, when you look at the art history painting and you see one of the trope of painting is the Madonna and Child, no? It's a benchmark for painters, similarly to portraits and landscapes. And I truly never understood why this trope of painting. I mean, I understood that there's, you know, some religious propaganda or a philosophical necessity to find a beginning for the humankind. No, so I understand that part of the subject matter, that, you know, it was fitting a certain requirement at some point, a philosophical need, a religious propaganda. But I realized that it was actually so much more, a much more common and touching humankind of experience. And maybe that's why so many painters made of this, the idea of being mother, the trope of painting. And it traversed so much of the history of painting, because it is a transforming experience for women and for men together. So maybe this is something I understood only becoming a mother. I thought, you see, I became a different art appreciator because something in my banal, normal family life happened that made me completely change my lenses through which I see what I usually teach, no? Which is history of art, history of architecture, the tropes of painting, and it made me change the way I see. I see some of the past I thought I knew.
What do you think is the key to living a good life?
Oh my God, I don't know. I made some choices that I'm not sure that are key to live a good life, but some choices that help me find a sense of purpose. And maybe that purpose brings a sense of stability, that what I'm doing is what I should be doing. I mean, I know I said I'm an educator, but I think it's a little bit more than being an educator. What I do, I think I plant myself in one organization and I work towards one mission, which is the School of Architecture. I think this gave me freedom and privilege to make a lasting difference for many people. Being an educator was a surprise, actually, for me, to be honest with you. I didn't understand that being an educator was creating a legacy, beside, you know, the fact that you learn and you teach, but also became an important component of me leading a good life. Mm-hmm. I think practicing only in my office would never be as fulfilling without a real and concrete engagement in society. So just to say that to me, teaching is not a job. It is what actually makes life meaningful, is to understand that you have agency on a larger group of people that enjoy your presence and understand your presence is important. And I think you having the privilege of making a difference in other people's life and creative life, I think it's incredibly rewarding. And I think in any practice, having a social component is not a waste of time. It's actually what makes the project go beyond somebody's capability into much bigger hands, into a much bigger network. I think that is never an individual journey. So maybe that's something that came through age. I think this, you know, intellectual and design values are nurtured by strong communities, self-confident community. Being part of one, I think, is very important. I think it's also very important to defeat this tendency that there is today of being self-sufficient and accept the fact that we are in mutual dependence of one another. And you have to come to terms with the limitation of reality and still lead a positive advancement for many. And this has been many, you know, maybe at the beginning when I became the chair of the program at SIRC, was definitely an adjustment to understand that you are only as good as the people that work with you or work for you are, and that actually they bring a value you don't have, and that their collaboration, with all the inefficiency of any collaboration possible and all the frustration that you might have because you have people that are different than you doing things that you would like to be done differently. But besides all of this, you really come to terms that self-sufficiency will never allow you to reach to the level of completion in life that you can with other people in a community. And I think our society really pushes for self-sufficiency and individuality and genius and special creation, newness, and you do it all alone. In all reality, being part of a community and managing to lead a positive change for many, maybe not the perfect change that you would have wanted on paper before, but still managing a compromise, but positive change is truly more than what you could do alone. And, you know, collaboration makes a big part of the satisfaction of having and leading a good life. I think the great achievements in life are found in the giving and receiving of care of many. And the more people you can touch and reach with your work and with your enthusiasm, the better life you're going to have in terms of just personal richness.
I absolutely agree with all of that. you mentioned legacy. And I was going to ask you if you thought about that, but I guess you have. But have you ever thought about it in a different way, whether it's architecture or having a child or anything else?
In general, my work will hopefully, if I can, if they allow me to, will always try to find a legacy working with institution whose mission I believe in. And, you know, they could be schools or museums or cultural institution that promote arts, education. I truly believe that my contribution to the world is a philanthropic. I would love to be part of a philanthropic institution in general. I think it's, as a creative being, I enjoyed, and I was the first-hand receiver of very generous scholarships when I was in school, or opportunities to show my work and to produce my work. It's part of, I think, being a creative person to also be given the chance to do the work you do. I think I've been lucky enough to have been given those opportunities when I was in school or just out of school or in my first year of teaching. I think it's important and it's a natural progression that role changes. And now I'm more on the support of other individuals when I work as a chair. What we do is, you know, I headhunt for talents and for people that can come to school and create this incredible community, or I connect them with possible work opportunities. I welcome donations, certain things that actually make a stronger community much beside my own practice, which I have and I love doing. And this is, you know, the legacy of my work will stay in the artwork I make. But I think there is also that second legacy, which for me is, can you then enable a creative community to happen? And that also is, I think, part of growing up is to understand, you know, that those things move around. And if in a certain time of your life, you need to receive them, at a certain time of your life, actually you need to donate them. And these are equally joyful moments.
So you mentioned being part of a philanthropic organization of some sort. Are there any other personal or professional goals or things you hope to achieve or accomplish in your lifetime?
I definitely would like to grow my office more. This is something that I've been working on for a while with the people in my office. They're all fantastic individuals. So I think we are the pivoting point to get bigger projects, more grand art projects. So I think architecture and arts are still what I need to do. And we accomplish a certain scale of work and we're moving to larger scale of work, which I think is something that would enable the office to have a stronger legacy, more durable footprint on in the architectural domain. So I think we are really much looking towards that.
Do you have any projects that our listeners should note or be on the lookout for?
We have been working quite a bit in Chinatown lately with a developer that has been gracious enough to give us a few canvases to work on. And that has been not only a great relationship, but also a fun experiment. We also are working a lot in Asia right now on larger projects for a stadium. And so we hope that that will go to fruition. And I mean, the office is also producing two books that will be published by the end of the year. Those are collections of the work we've been doing in the past 5 or 6 years in the practice. It's been also a moment of reflection to focus on what the body of work looks like and how to then progress to the next phase of the office. So that has been a fun experience this summer to put together an extensive publication and putting words to the words of the images.
That's fantastic. And where can our listeners find you on the web and social media?
www.ateliermansardini.com or Instagram, the ubiquitous social media, Atelier Manfredini.
Great. Well, thank you, Elena. This has been such a great conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks for listening, everyone. To see images of Elena's work and read the show notes, click the link in the details of this episode on your podcast app or go to cleverpodcast.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Clever on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd also do us a favor and rate and review, it really, really helps.
We love to chat with you guys on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can always find us there at Clever Podcast. Clever is created, produced, and hosted by us, Amy Devers and Jamie Derringer, also known as 2VDE Media, with editing by Rich Stroffolino and music by L1011. Clever is proudly distributed by Design Milk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.